Remains of an Indian village. This, incidentally, has been revised. Underfoot, rotten boards, forest rubble, bones. Animals were here after the plague, after smallpox, to make another ending. For the tutelary gods of decay, acknowledge aid from any quarter. Here the charging cotyledons of spring press green forefingers on femurs, vertebra, and delicate bell skulls of children. The moon's waylaid light does not shrink from bone relics and other beauties of nature. Death is certainly absent now. Death takes, they say, implies theft, cessation, annulment, leaves, mechanical men unwound, and the birth certificate of cedars specifies no memory of a village. And I have seen myself fade from a woman's eyes while I was standing there, and the earth was aware of me no longer. As I observe the wispy legs of children running in this green light from a distant star into the near forest, wood violets and trilliums of 100 years ago, blooming and vanishing. The villages of the brown people, toppling and returning. What moves and lives, occupying the same space? What touches what touched them, owes them? Standing knee-deep in the joined earth of their weightless bones, in the archaeological sunlight, the trembling voltage of summer, in the sunken reservoirs of rain, standing waist-deep in the crisscross rivers of shadows, in the village of nightfall, the hunters silent, and women bending over dark fires, I hear their broken consonants. A quarrel. Lying side by side, naked in darkness, bodies stiff with anger, tempered thoughts clashing like swords in the room's corners. Limited sort of agony. It doesn't kill you, but almost does. The moon sinks teeth in bedroom, ivory ones without cavities. Chews at the curtain rod, drags both one-time lovers into its twitching pattern. Self-conscious on mare embryum. Mare embryum, my darling, running with great 30-foot strides in the apogee and perigee of love, throwing handfuls of pumice and sliding down the shale hills in a dream slalom to lacus mortis and lacus somniorum, where youth is a twinkle in the eye of the absolute. Self-conscious on mare embryum? Mad as hell in a bedroom in Ameliasburg Township. Even as in the councils of the great, my darling, in the consultations of the kings of earth, a small quarrel like ours is not for solving. Hymie's hymn. The setting of this one is Johnston's Furniture Factory in Saint-Germain in Montreal, in 1960. Hymie's hymn. Hymie, of thee I sing, the journeyman upholsterer, spitting tacks and anti-Semites, forgetful of the Elohim, being a Montreal Jew boy, getting by and prospering moderately in a hard Gentile trade. Of thee I sing, Hymie, and of the mattress factory on Saint-Germain, of the marvelous church down the street with a backyard rink full of rocket Richards, of pale Theresa who worked in the cutting room and whose beauty was more perfect than a straight seam, of little fat Tony on the filling machine, who raged scornfully at my slow 200 pounds. But principally of thee, Hymie, grandiose with a pair of sharp scissors, disliking all bosses outside the union ethic, but privately allowing them to be perhaps human, for kindness that was not without irritation, for being almost exactly, though not quite, yourself. I wish for thee foremanship of a factory, greater than Johnston's on Saint-Germain, the eternal confusion of thine enemies. May they remain apprentices forever and choke on a mouthful of 12-ounce tacks, that the Elohim may finally remember Hymie Sloane, for thine is the kingdom of man. Indian summer. In the big house, with the heat turned off, lights flashed on for a night, and trickets... Jesus. Indian summer. In the big house, with the heat turned off, lights flashed on for a night, and crickets trapped in the wainscoting chirped in drowsy sleep. The high sky of the painted ceiling turned blue again and bird-haunted, and over the echoes rolled from the little dog's excited ki-yi-ing. Briefly, briefly, all things make the sounds that are theirs. The moon comes drifting through the hollow, windy living room and the paint-flaked kitchen, equipped with all the latest old-fashioned appliances, is full of hunger and empty of all but need. Words here are simpering imbeciles, dare not hope to break the silence. Only the falling plaster does, and the returning cold. Polytheism. Wanamaker said he saw a god up there, past Cirrus and Cumulus. Finkel denounced this claim as horseshit in the officer's mess. And leaning on the grand piano, he developed his own thesis that God was a blind tail gunner with a fundamental dislike for pilots. After the strafing, they were found under the debris, with mouths open, still filled with the word God and blood. Epitaph. We who have known the names of things, the garter snake coiled in words, orioles a taste on the tongue, pike glowing in the spring river. We were strangers from Attica, writing home from a foreign country, describing everything as part of a foreign landscape, except ourselves. We who have known the names of things, have forgotten them all. We have forgotten the name of the human town we lived in, even the names of the others, for moss, Bryophyta, grows over. Rural henhouse. A stink assails the nostrils delicately. Number 2 twists and avoids the hatchery. 401 sails serenely on, laid out by a Roman drunk, no doubt. Here on rural Highway 28, dirt with gravel under, potholes like catastrophes. Negotiable by Ford, Chevy, and Plymouth. Plymouth Rocks assert supremacy, challenged only by Buff Arpington, and white leghorns in these green dominions of vanquished hawks, and lost territorial domain of weasels duped electrically, and rats dispatched by science. These call girls coaxed by kilowatt chicanery delay for more than 24 hours. Apart from world's public incubator, that giant kennel, this unscrubbed, unsterile uterus uprears on painted boards in a barnyard nook. And who pecks whom is the battle cry? Well, Pithecanthropus erectus round the kitchen midden peers. Disguised as Homo sapiens, he asserts his own supremacy. The registered cows in AID. Worships new fertility gods. Delicious ground cantharides, as sure as a prophet from a loss. The mamas stalk like Caesar's wives across the barnyard. Brown mothers, red cap roosters, newborn chicks. The mamas stalk like Caesar's wives across the barnyard. Brown mothers, red cap roosters, newborn chicks. Chirruping yellow powder puffs. O pterodactyl's child. Quiz custodiate of the green morning. Aki Homo in the family Wittershins, who is viable but unattractive. The farmer, secretive, close-hinged, essays for all of us, including him, a proper, honest, and agrarian smile. And in those faraway, high-climbing, ice-blue cities, in warmed-over fourth-floor apartments, distant semi-detached villas, chill duplex bungalows, frowning tenants eye hungrily, orange embryos on porcelain and blue table, those boiled elliptical billiard balls skittishly rolling into penultimate egg cups. Some inner part of you and me awaits helplessly, along with, somehow misunderstood and ludicrous, all originally clean things come loitering in across the sun's white tablecloth. Uneasily our bound and gagged selves await like catatonics, the abrupt and violating spoon. Let us eat now. Remember Wilfred Owen's poem? There's a couple of little stumbles there, isn't there? Aren't there? Yeah. Where were they?
After
was it? Along with, somehow misunderstood and ludicrous, all originally clean things come loitering in across the sun's white tablecloth. Uneasily our bound and gagged selves await like catatonics the abrupt and violating spoon. Let us eat now. That's the last poem in Poems for All the Inettes. This is Emu Remember, published by Fiddlehead Poetry Books, University of New Brunswick, in 1957. Emu Remember. Emu Remember, done to death by a pavement clown on a windy Saturday of bare branches and blowing birds of passage. Emu Remember, the sun gallops, the song yearnings and basket lunches. Of not to be remembered home and heart heat crying, the body's awkwardness and oval egg. The undertaken adventure of dying, come on a spoiled eye and broken twig. Emu Remember, in your monochrome world, the mine color, strung bead sound of live lovers. And failing that, hold tight in dead aviary, the bright thing found. That's another imitation of Dylan Thomas. Milton Wilson once reviewed that and had all sorts of symbolic things into it. Actually, somebody sneaked into Stanley Park in Vancouver and killed the emus. This next poem, Elegy for a Grandfather, has been revised and revised and is now very different. However, I'll read the old version. Well, he died, didn't he? They said he did. His wide whalebone hips will make a prehistoric barrow. Kitchen midden for mice under the rough sod, where relatives stood in real and pretended sorrow for the dearly beloved gone at last to God after a bad century, a tough, turbulent farrah with a deck of cards in his pocket and a Presbyterian grin. Well, maybe he did die, but the boy didn't see it. The man knows now, and the whimsical tale is told of a lying lumberjack with a fist like a piece of suet, a temper like toppling timber, and splintering words to scald the holy ears of an angel, and a beautiful man in a riot, but a bright, bragging boy's hero with a pocket full of gold, like a Neolithic swear word from the opposite end of time. No doubt at all that he's dead, a sadly virtuous voice folded tragedy sideways and glossed his glittering sins. Old in his ancient barrow, no one could ever guess that the shy fox people's children play with his gnarled gray bones, or green Glengarry River sluices his grave and sighs. And earth is another tenant, involved in her muttering plans, the deck of cards in his pocket, and a Presbyterian grin. Poem. Here am I at 6 o'clock, with the world growing plain in the sun. Here am I of a Sunday, the only one awake, having come here through 30 years, in order to arrive when birds' wings flash, and grasses glow green for me a short time. No wind, but tall clouds, and crows cawing home together. Whatever it means isn't very important now, summed up for me to discover in casual rhymes. I take a deep breath. Feel the angling sunbeams make me a confluence, established by vectors of light, like candles burning in space for a hunchback prince. Here we are at the same poem. Well, there were about 2 poems in this book that went into this book. Shall I read it again? Okay. Cantos. He cries his sickness. Nostrum specific physic have tempered the malaise somewhat. Methinks the witch would let me live, but I would not. Ague in bones, night risings, pleggy fever, staked out in daisy field to nourish flies, let ants discover, and various beetles gelled. He discerns the cause. Albeit the maid is fair beyond all need, but shrewish, spiteful, deaf to please, shouts of anguish. God will punish her, but not enough. Meanwhile she scourges me, plumps herself in chair, smiles, arranges skirts, claps hands, glitters under lamps, forsooth, while poor Ma singes wings, moans, gulps to her giggles. Lover of oddment she once wore. Oof, lout and churl, in fief forever to barony of yellow hair. He decides to live. Harkee now, the mildewed beldame in High Street hath cured all ill. I shout, I sing, I laugh at the wan, woesome dog's lopped tail that was I. Howl hard to full moons, Morion, thy drunken ditch, or dream of beldame's daughter, the rich, ripe roan mare, and the shining of her. This also was in the other book, Indictment. Same thing entirely. Okay. I'll pass on to Proust. In Proust, one senses the intense clairvoyance that shows the skeleton from a god's viewpoint. Whatever happens is distinct from the author's presence. He presides later at the baptismal font, picks their skulls like a delicate vulture from the fourth dimension, without risk of the cadaver stiffening remotely in torture. Another visage peering behind the gray death mask. I think I kind of screwed that up, eh? Pardon? Oh, yeah, well, I think I screwed it apart from that shall I read it, eh? Proust. In Proust, one senses the intense clairvoyance that shows the skeleton from a god's viewpoint. Whatever happens is distinct from the author's presence. He presides later at the baptismal font and picks their skulls like a delicate vulture from the fourth dimension. Without risk of the cadaver stiffening remotely in torture, another visage peering behind the gray death mask. I probably still screwed it up. Cadaver. Okay. In mid-Atlantic, the ocean, battering at my aloneness, creams into supplicating shapes, lifts arms, and whispers with the gray knowledge of the dead. Ours is the only true identity. Sea voices crying in the night outside, the terrier-shaken ship, bring all the legends into green focus, provide a brute antagonist outside myself. That necessary mindlessness, something to overcome dispassionately, as neuter distance is, or mountains to climb. And gliding through these halls of trembling glass like a strange flaw, we are accompanied, gulls skimming deeper down than brown hull goes, and all my joy goes with them, the tough carrion gods of the water, moving behind the midnight tirelessly. The fashion of despair, the rebellious season of doubt ends, as youth does, with involvement in one coast or another. The ship plunges down and smothers to death and climbs up with the gulls. A poem called Invocation, which is about the most exact imitation of Dylan Thomas I think I ever did. Although, I've seen Invocation. Mourn for snow, the sun staring, the blue memory of hip-high drifts and town mirage. The shading, the symmetry of trees beneath snowflakes. Jesus Christ. Invocation. Mourn for snow. The sun staring, the blue memory of hip-high drifts and town mirage. The shading, the symmetry of trees beneath slow flakes. Flowers in a lonesomeness of young age. And morning, white morning, after the windy yesterdays. In the forest of always Sunday. Roads in white nowhere on strange errands. Only wire hum, foot heartbeat audible, and terror telling. The steady sky falling torrents, as a woman should be, a woman most beautiful. The horse clapping, the bell ringing time of earth, the cloud beaten, wind bullied hammers of blood bursting in noiseless thunder. No sound heard, only the sky emissaries slow going to bed. Send snow, send it white in this land of green trees and small brown people, comptroller of all my days. Who who does not understand. Midnight in Troy, the hour when the legend split, and Troilus, dragged off by obedient Achilles, also loved an imaginary Cressida, that girl in Helen, whose warm, welcoming bellies tempered medieval steel and stung the Renaissance and raffish Elizabethan studs with itching loins. Well, we do exaggerate, perhaps, but once there were women who stuck long pins in men, pricked nerves, slashed pride, and shriveled egos, who mere dazzle drove their beauty through the dry, sealed centuries, whose damp bedroom sagas bewitched kings, butchers, and eunuchs, one scholar says. So, my dear, when the hot breath whistles at midnight in the bedroom, give thanks and pray for the secret statue another Leonardo chisels, and the lovers might have lost each other so easily. News item. Ice boats nearly extinct in eastern Canada. How are they important? Even of beauty, I am not sure. The heyday and high of wind remain. I came to an idea I was waiting for, and time is a wound, delivered when new things can't strike flame, no longer new is love. The white sails sigh in another room, what thin partitions we have. The plum tree blooms in a jeweler's tray, the lapidary's thumb dissects the rapture of one spring day. Ice boats minutely skim rivers and lakes, in mind and heart, accompanied or alone. Nobody knows how old they are, till the costly dreams begin. Contraband. My 13-year-old world was smaller than it is now, but I thought it large, and knew there were misshapen rats in the cellar that gnawed corpse bones that answered to George. George, knock those rats in the bleeding head and get up to the kitchen, George, you sad. Those things beyond my knowledge, I imagined that aldermen were wise and kings brave, and all but I perpetuate the legend that even married men might die for love. George, take that silly rope off your neck. I need the clothesline. You can use a gun if you like. Then I saw the daisy, now the whole white flame of walled flowers on astigmatic eye. Then was no thought of more. Now visions come, that turn full cycle in a childhood sea. George, darling, I think you're really a dreamer. I tell you, honey, I'm in disguise. I'm a vampire. But the remembered candy doesn't taste as good, except as a sort of cerebral taffy, predigested pablum internally fed, and the adult smell is bad. The rooms are stuffy. The point seems to elude. Well, no wonder. At least there were adults then to believe in, the giants of those days, the opposite gender with peach bloom looks and a lovely approach to sin. But take thought on the lost potential, the might have been theologist, philosopher, or cop, with sacristy oil, serene brow, or innocent of thought, without the troublesome things that break in your sleep. What remains? Only these gibbets, the fierce red eyes of yourself that see all. The dripping blood of dreams, the terrible lack of fear, the wide, wide open eyes, the feet that knowingly walk to another room. But George, you mustn't say those things, you mustn't. It spoils my appetite for lunch. Besides, nobody listens. The Cave Painters. The world was a gallery for their concept of selfishness that creates an end beyond itself of essential bone, bare in the sun when flesh rots, being something else from what they wear, through interstices and cracks in character and soft carapace. And the usurious precursor of clocks ticked in the salmon sky and soundless wood. But such a saber is discontent, slapping the legs with purple bruises, having no ease from custom, growing blunt from usage. They knew the world was there, beyond the indefinite clearing. The ringed, acute horizon existed past the rock edge of their staring. The evidence of flawed cornea, intense enough to execute plans, conciliate orange tigers, and trade a flint axe for raw blue lens, dead deer for a nebulous something scolded at by wives. A torn oryx dragged down by dogs one day that desperately lives on beneath the bloody snarling heads. He knew the world was there, having discovered an ache in the loins, a clarity of color, shores beyond their shores, become inhabitants of loneliness, applicants to leave the mind prison, be dissolved in the miscreation and absorbed. It became an imperfection and revolved within high walls around a half-tame minotaur and slunk off simpering where the women were. Stumble? Cornea? Yeah. Cornea? Cornea. Okay. Cornea. The evidence of flawed cornea. Intense enough to execute plans. Okay. Only two more. Postscript. This was revised since, but is much different in the revision. Postscript. I say the stanza ends, but it never does. There being something continual, apart from the blaze of man in a woman. At least he somehow thinks there is. After a parting grimly convivial, nostalgia comes like an old shaman. Says alley-oop, and there like a proud queen, an obscure Flemish painter did, and never forgot. Her slow fire burns at Valladolid and tizzling ghost. Oh, well. I say the stanza ends, but it never does. There being something continual, apart from the blaze of man in a woman. At least he somehow thinks there is. After a parting grimly convivial, nostalgia comes like an old shaman. Says alley-oop, and there like a proud queen an obscure Flemish painter did, and never forgot. Her slow fire burns at Valladolid in drizzling rain, hissing like a cat, the rich blood smoldering, the black eyes like storms. But she is nothing imagined. The green shimmer of mind evergreens, the liquid insomnia of prenatal memories in day sky, being perishable and flesh. But in her was clamor of voices, the structure of music, the diamond flaw of regret that intricate, irreplaceable things must die. Flies in Amber, another Dylan Thomas imitation. I held in mountain shape, rolled tight in tree bud, clasped in clouds, belled hound's tongue, train scream, caught up and captured by these gods. Cannot get free of color, shape, sound, of live things, rich things, mine, in lapsing wave whisper, green blend of brain, leaf pulse, and brown fawn. I, stung by youth, stretch, reach, run. Rotate round suns and tramp down time, court Blake and Marlowe, question done. Think back hours, years, readless dream, grow lank, soul thin, flesh weak, eyes blind. In such extremities, approach new lands. There's a little note at the end of it. Should I read it? The author, born once upon a time in a mythological village called Wooler. Mythological because the same village could not be now found. Height and weight, tall and heavy, but unlikely to cause a collapse of athletic stadiums. Education from institutions, nil. From approximately 10,000 books, considerably more. From living, a great deal more. Military career, checkered. Religion, show me. Marital status, almost. Disposition, cloudy and variable. Present occupation, scribbling. Hope for the future? To write one novel. I doubt it now, though. Oh, Christ, what awful crap, though, eh?